took forever. Hello, you are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. I'm your host,
that was awesome.
Tom Chick. That's a little police in the background. The fellow you just heard talking is Christian Zubrinsky.
Yeah, that's me. Just don't call me Minnie.
We also have with us Kelly Wand.
I only wish when I'm dead.
Awesome. I'm sorry, you only wish when you're dead what, Kelly Wand?
If they saved me, he had a face made for podcasting.
Is that your tagline this week?
Yeah, I got a few, but that's the only one I'm going to say.
You're going to save the other ones for later?
Well, one of them is, it's not our topic for the evening, but this is the weekend that Twilight New Moon came out.
Right.
Maybe New Moon Twilight, and it broke all box office records and made like $800 million in 15 minutes or something.
Right.
So my catchphrase this week is teenage girls are gay. Because werewolves with shaved chests are gay. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Everything always breaks all records.
Twihards, more like twitards.
What?
They're known as twihards, people who's...
Oh, because they lend to Twilight.
Yeah, and my mom is a twitard, and she has a friend who saw the original Twilight so many times, and this is true. It's just funny enough to be true. She'd wear disguises so the ushers wouldn't recognize her and, like, drive across town, because she was kind of an agoraphobiac, too.
Wow, okay.
So...
Okay.
Remember when all the old women went to go see 8 Mile? And they were like, oh, he's such a sweet young boy. It's like that.
I did not know that. Was 8 Mile big in that demographic?
Only that demographic.
So that's not this week's, though, topic. Unless, did you see Twilight, Kelly Wand?
No. All right. And I'm very indebted to you for talking me out of us doing New Moon this weekend, which I was going to be adamant against, and then for half a second I went, maybe it'll be funny, and then you guys just...
Hey, I put my foot down. I'm the one.
Yeah, no, I totally appreciate that. You guys were so... I'm so glad I wasn't in charge.
Well, we only have to do... Like, we did 2012 last week, so we only have to do our penance.
We made our point.
Kind of stuff. Right. We can move on to...
That's our blockbuster for 2009.
Sure, so we can move on to more serious movies, like this week's choice... which was An Education. I think, Dingus, you were responsible for singling this one out, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that is correct.
And why did you single out for us to watch this week An Education?
I just heard some good... the problem is I don't watch trailers, as many of you know. I don't read reviews.
I think that's smart. I support.
Yeah, I do too.
You shouldn't listen to podcasts either.
Really? Yeah, let's stop this right now.
Well, wait, we should make clear, in case you don't it by now and you're listening, this podcast is spoiler. It's a spoiler podcast. It's only for people who have seen An Education. If you
so
have
it's
not
another
seen
excuse
it,
not to listen to this.
If you have not seen it, fast forward to our 3x3. That is more spoiler safe. And then come back and listen to this after you've seen An Education.
Which you should.
Yeah. So Dingus, I cut you off. So you were saying... you don't watch trailers. I presume you didn't know much about this movie. What made you pick it?
I knew nothing about it other than it had won some awards, and you know, I really didn't even go back to see. I think it had won something at the Cannes Film Festival, and it has Peter Sarsgaard in it, and I really, really like that guy. Whoa.
Really, really like
him? Yeah, I know.
Would you say you have a man crush on Peter Sarsgaard?
I'm not going to go that far, although I did see him naked in a different movie last week. But I think he's great. And so he's, you know, since I have so little, exposure to new films, one good actor or director or writer is enough to recommend a film to me if a bunch of people that I trust have not. And nobody I know has seen this. And I don't know. I just had a feeling it was building up ahead of steam. I just heard some popular stuff about it, and so I thought we should see it.
It had definitely come out of the sort of like a film festival circuit. Like, it had its little film festival circuit buzz going. Now, Kelly, you don't have the aversion that Dingus and I have to watching trailers. So tell us.
Yeah, I do. I'm too lazy to, you know, get out of it sometimes.
Well, what I'm curious about is what did you know about an education going into it?
I didn't know it was set in 1961. I didn't know who was in it. I didn't know who Carey Mulligan was.
Boy, you do now, though, I bet.
I just want to say...
Did you say you didn't know it was set in 1961, or you did know?
I didn't know anything about it. Yeah. I didn't know A Serious Man was about Jews before I saw it. I just
spoiler.
Go, oh, it's movie. Right.
Don't spoil the other movies we've talked about.
Don't spoil the other podcasts.
Yeah, like this movie isn't about Jews.
I just want to say, not to toot my own horn, but I wasn't sure if Carey Mulligan was actually 16. So during the movie, I only masturbated twice.
You know, I'm surprised we've come. Is this maybe our seventh podcast? I'm surprised we've made it through seven podcasts before Kelly Wan said something grossly inappropriate.
It's time.
So I've got to, it is time.
You know what? She's 24, so that joke's fine in a Letterman kind of way. Right?
Well, he actually laid the groundwork last week by claiming that he goes to movies in a raincoat. So
that was more elliptical. This one was much more like Kelly Wan just crossing the boundary.
It was time. You know what? Let's narrow our demographic down to no one.
Let's get them in the real Kelly Wand.
Right. I feel like I've been falsely.
I've seen that. That's a reality show, I think.
Socially acceptable.
So she's 24, though. She's not
she's
like,
24, and she's a child actor. And she has that same luminosity that Rachel McAdams kind of had when you first saw Rachel McAdams. Like,
I was thinking more Anne. I was thinking more Anne Hathaway. I think she had
and her too. There was a time when I thought Anne Hathaway wasn't hot. Did you guys go through that phase? And now I look back on that era with stupefaction.
Well, I'm glad you've come to your senses.
Anyway, getting back to Carey Mulligan.
So let's talk about the movie rather than just about how hot Carey Mulligan may or may not be.
There's a movie?
So I also had no idea that it was like a period piece. I didn't even know. You could tell from the poster it's going to be something romantic. I didn't know if it was going to be like a romantic comedy.
When I heard the music at the beginning, I go, oh, it's going to be a Dirty Dancing kind of thing. It's going to be a British Dirty Dancing. And in a way it is, but it's good.
Okay. So I was Peter Sarsgaard, though. That's why I also wanted to see it. Like that dingus I knew as much as you did. I knew him from the poster.
He's not British, right?
He's so not British, and his accent did distract me.
Yep.
I was like, dude, no, you're no Meryl Streep. This isn't working for me. But my thing with Peter Sarsgaard, I sort of feel like if Peter Sarsgaard likes you, that's like you're really cool. Like if you have a movie and Peter Sarsgaard likes your character, that is like carte blanche for your character. That's like serious acceptance.
You're a Hayden Christensen apologist. Shattered Glass.
Or Zach Braff, for instance. Like anybody who has Peter Sarsgaard as their friend in a movie, that's the movie shorthand for, hey, you're really cool. If Peter Sarsgaard likes you, you're down. Yeah.
But it also...
Hello?
Wow. Dingus was struck speechless.
He makes a good point.
I mean, not good things happen to those two things you just suggested.
Dingus, you went silent. You were struck speechless.
Can you not hear me right now?
Now we hear you. Yes, you're fine.
What I said was that it also spells a little bit of doom for you if he likes your character.
Well, here's one of my problems with. Before we'll talk in sort of more blanket terms.
I have some problems too, so we'll see if it's the same problem.
Okay, one of my problems with the movie is that there's this sort of spoiler by casting thing that goes on with certain actors. Anytime you cast Peter Sarsgaard, you know he's going to end up being a little weaselly, a little slimy.
No, in Shattered Glass, he was the upright guy.
There are exceptions, but that's his sort of shtick, is the guy who ends up being sort of like a pathetic, slimy guy, you know, who does underhanded things. That's how he started in Boys Don't Cry. That's how he was in Garden State. I mean, that's his shtick. So there was this sort of weird spoiler by casting where, because I knew nothing about it, as the movie's going on, I'm like, you know, I bet he's going to turn out to be a jerk. And they sort of tease that out slowly enough, but I could see it coming.
Yeah, he's a stealth jerk.
Yes, well put, a stealth jerk.
This is just a small point, but did I catch a character saying that he married his sister in the movie? Didn't Danny say that, the friend? He goes, I may be a bastard, and then he goes, well, I didn't marry my sister. Neither of you guys remember him saying that.
I think you accidentally watched the Royal Tenenbaums.
Dude. Really? I'm the only one? Okay, all right. Because I thought the wife is his sister, too, and that was part of, which none of which is in her memoir. I don't know if you guys read it for your research.
Well, Kelly, why don't you tell us what's the source material for this movie?
The source material is this reporter named Lynn Barber, who is a reporter and wrote about this.
And
she wrote a memoir about it, and they made a movie about it. And she said, in the memoir, she cuts some of the things that I thought didn't work in the movie wound up not being true. Which most of that had to do for me with Alfred Molina's character, her dad.
Boy, howdy.
I found his passivity wasn't believable. And according to the memoir, when it was exposed that this 35-year-old man who seduced his 16-year-old daughter is married and has a kid, in real life, like, the dad tried to punch him when he came over, and then he kicked his car, and she was in the house laughing and screaming, scratch it, scratch the bodywork.
And that's not in the movie. That doesn't make for a very neat and tidy coming-of-age movie, though.
No, but I thought the movie needed a few more scenes like that, like just more authentic.
Well, I agree with you there. I mean, I do think that it was kind of packaged pretty neatly. Like, by the time it had to wind up and have a resolution, it did feel awfully pat.
Yeah, and my favorite scene, in fact, was the one where she goes to Emma Thompson to beg her way back into school after her scandalous affair, and Emma Thompson just torpedoes her. Like, it's so cruel, but it's kind of true. It's like you think it's going to be the scene where she goes, all right, you've learned your lesson. Like, she's going to be the ugly teacher redeemer.
That I didn't care for. I mean, then she just immediately turns to the understanding teacher and gets redeemed. I mean, it was sort of like they had
that part stuck.
Had Olivia Williams in the other pocket to sort of take up the slack.
Right. But I thought the rejection, when she gets rejected, I thought...
I didn't believe any of that stuff. Any of those scenes are ridiculous.
Which, by the way, let's talk about. But I just want to say it didn't overall impact. Like, I quite like the movie overall. I just feel like the ending was a little too pat. And like Dingus, like you were saying, I didn't find a lot of that believable. The only part at the ending that I really liked, and it's mainly because I really like Alfred Molina, was him at the door, sort of apologizing, and where he discloses that they found out that C.S. Lewis lived in Cambridge and not Oxford. I mean, that was like more sort of scenes with these characters sort of confessing that they failed her. I think that, like, that was a very powerful scene.
In real life, the dad went to beg the headmistress to take her back. So the dad actually gets a bad rap in the movie.
Right.
That moment when the dad's at the door almost saved his character for me. But that whole ridiculous raging and ranting about the trees, it just forget it.
Well, he's played. Yeah, it's that classic kids movie thing. Like, it's a classic, I think, coming of age movie thing too, where the adults are ineffectual and they don't understand the children, and the children are wise, and the movie sort of fell prey to some of that.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I was just gonna say the movie sort of fell prey to some of that, and that I think it would have been a stronger story if it didn't sort of take that cheap, easy way out so often.
He was supposed to represent, like, a middle-class dude who just thought the idea of Oxford was better. Like, those guys are kind of bruisers, aren't they, generally? Like, even British types?
The Oxford types?
Yeah. Like, wouldn't they be a little more suspicious of... I don't know. I mean, it happened in real life, so what about... I'm trapped in the
body. You know, I think that he is sort of a central problem in this film, and this may be one of the first times that I really disagree with the two of you guys. His reactions throughout the film as a father, I never bought, and for that reason, I had a hard time accepting anything in the film as anything other than and this is just my problem, as anything other than through the lens of memoir, and therefore really, really distorted.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, it is, and that's sort of the problem with coming of age movies is when you're coming of age, you can't really make a movie or write a novel at that point. It always tends to be sort of a look back. And I think Lynn Barber's book is actually called in parentheses a memoir. And there is a lot of that dingus. Yeah.
Well, I think it says that at the beginning of the film, doesn't it? Something like this is based on a memoir or a memoir or something like that.
Well, that's the name. So Lynn Barber wrote a book and Nick Hornby adapted part of the book that was published in a magazine into this movie.
That's what I meant to say.
Well, no, you got it.
I didn't even know Nick Hornby. I didn't even know enough to know that Nick Hornby had written this. And it's funny is that I was sitting there watching the opening credits and thinking, this makes me feel like about a boy. And then Nick Hornby's name cropped up and I went, oh.
He's the one who got it made. He championed it for a long time. It took years.
Dingus, so you mentioned like the Alfred Molina as the father being unbelievable. So did that, and you say that sort of colors the movie as a memoir, did that sort of damage it for you?
It's one of many things that did.
Ah.
I was really excited about seeing this and really loved a lot of it through it, but so much of it knocked it down for me. And as I've thought about it over the last day and a half or so, it really did damage it. I cannot get past that first scene where what's
Simon?
The character's name? What's Sarsgaard's character's name? I can't
David.
Remember.
David. It's David.
David.
That's what I meant. Simon's his name in RL. Sorry.
David Simon. That's right. He went on to fight Homicide. The Wire. When he comes in and convinces them for the first time that he's going to take her out, and it's just so easy, and the father's just because he's embarrassed about the Jew thing, just basically says, "Okay, have fun." I just couldn't believe
that happened in real life, though.
Well,
said in real life he was short and ugly, long faced and splay footed, and her dad still endorsed him.
Real life, whatever. It's how she views her life through her memoir, and how she colors herself and wants to paint herself, and that's fine. But there's so much of this, and it develops as the film goes on, and I really really liked the actress, but there's so much of this Gilmore Girls talking that it just got in my way, and I just kept thinking, this is how you want to think you were. I don't believe this is how you were based on how your parents are being.
Now, so real quick, Dingus, so by Gilmore Girls way of talking, do you just mean sort of neat and pat and clever? I don't know the Gilmore Girls, but can you explain that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. So to take it as an example, the scene that she has with the headmistress as she's basically telling her, I'm leaving, she and they're having the argument, and she says, I think the quote is something like,
yes, God, I know exactly what you're going to say. Go on.
What is it? It's something like, it's a good argument.
You should practice. Yeah, it's a good argument.
You should rehearse it.
It's something like, it's a good
ask what it's all about.
The line is something like, it's a good argument to rehearse. Basically telling her, you should think of this argument for next time. And she's got such a knowing way of talking and sort of a glibness about the way she does it. And it's just so adult and knowing and just perfect that it drove me crazy.
Now, let me ask you, Dingus, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious how you would respond to this. One of your favorite movies from last year had a very similar character, and I'd be very interested in talking about the points of continuity with this
Juno?
Movie. And why didn't that bother you in Juno? Or did it? Dingus.
Was Juno last year or the year before?
Year before. Yeah. 10 years ago, I think.
Because for one thing, I never had the feeling that anybody in Juno was real, was based on a real person. And for the other thing, that the whole thing to me seemed stylized, that I accepted the stylization.
Okay. Sure.
And this is, I'm sort of doing this out of order.
This is why biopics suck.
Well, in some ways, and I really, I gotta tell you, I really, really wanted to love this film. And I loved her, but I was not, like Kelly said earlier, I was never under the delusion that she was anywhere south of 20. And
I wasn't.
And she had this sort of air about her, and they were doing this sort of, Audrey Hepburn thing with her, and she was very attractive and very winning and very bright. But I just never believed it. I just believed that this is somebody who wanted me to think this is, or this is just somebody having a fantasy of how she viewed herself, which is nice, but not a but not real.
It's not real too, because she's supposed to be 16, and so when you see this 24-year-old beauty, you kind of identify with him. Like, oh wait, she looks 24. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, she's not. In every movie where it's about a creepy older man and a younger girl, the younger girl is never played by someone of that actual age. Like in Lolita.
Well, I mean, Lolita, and you think of like Hard Candy with Ellen Page, you know.
I like that one though. That's actually the closest they've ever come to that.
But Ellen Page, I don't know how old she is, but
she looks young. Like she, this, what's her name? Who's the girl I'm in love with?
Carrie Mulligan. So,
Carrie Mulligan.
So, Dingus, you're saying then that it was partly that it didn't feel, would you say, sort of authentic enough? Like, because I agree with you. Like, Juno is entirely stylized. Juno has its own kind of internal fiction.
But it's not a biopic, and he's saying that's what, if you know it's real.
Well, no. I'm saying that, yeah, I think, Tom, you're on the right. I think both you're on the right track. From the beginning, I got a feeling of artificiality. And let me give you a concrete example of this from a filmmaking point of view. And this started to give me a bad feeling early in the movie, and I just kept pushing it away. The very first moment when they meet, when she's standing in the rain and he drives up to her. It's this lovely scene. It's very funny. There's this wonderful banter. It's a really cute little, well, it's a meet cute, where they're standing in the rain and he drives up and asks her to get in his car. And, it's so bright. It's very clear that they're filming in utter sunshine and shooting rain in from somewhere. The sun is shining off of everything around them, and there's just no way around that. And all I could think of, this should be dark. This should be dark. This should be dark. But they can't help that. They're shooting that day. And what it did for me was say, this is a film. This is artificial. This moment is artificial. All of this is artificial. And I pushed it away and pushed it away. But more and more of the film informed that.
That's odd to me. I mean, that strikes me as I mean, that just seems like sort of – I know what you're saying, Dingus. When I'm not into a movie, when it's not grabbing me, I notice stuff like that. And so stuff like that bothers me. But when I am into a movie, I don't really care about stuff like that. And I never noticed any of the, like, you know, lighting inconsistency or anything. So I wasn't as alienated from what they were trying to do as you seem to have been.
Well, also, artificiality has its place, too. Like, it could have been her memory of it seeming bright.
Well, that's way too much. Yeah, that's not at all what was
giving him too much credit.
Yeah, that's no. Like,
but please understand, I was begging, I was wanting it to suck me in. I mean, we had just seen 2012. That's the last theatrical experience I had.
So the bar was low.
And I just wanted to be sucked into this. Plus, I had recommended it, so I wanted it to be good.
Maybe 2012 made you hypersensitive to weather effects in movies.
Very good. If the film had transcended that, then I would have just dismissed it out of hand. But I'm afraid it informed what happened to come.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what the scene that did that for me, where I just went, this would never happen. This is so unbelievable. It was hurting my eyes. And I like the movie just because I fell for her, and it's British and it was quiet and mannered. And that's, some people just like all baseball movies, and I'm kind of an Anglophile. But getting back to my original point, the part that made the screenwriter in me kind of blanch is where she goes through David's glove compartment while her parents are in the back seat, and then reads the envelope and finds out that he's married.
Why did that make you blanch?
Because the parents don't react, and you don't see what – she goes, okay, we're going home right now. Like, they don't say anything. It's like in those Fast and Furious movies where you never see the driver of the truck they're robbing. That always annoys me too. It's like that guy's story isn't important enough to The fact that she's rifling through his belongings in front of her parents for the first time ever, like she's picking that moment.
Well, she's getting a cigarette and she sees all the envelopes in there. I mean, I that didn't bother me because I thought they, I mean, it needed to be very convenient. You know, her parents need to see her getting upset and there's the little tension about what did she find. That
but her dad just saw her rifle a glove compartment and go, oh my God, we gotta go, we gotta leave right now. And he saw her look at envelopes kind of, right?
Like, when he asks her what's the matter and she says, you know, go inside, I'll be in a second. I mean, it was contrived. I was okay with that. But I think they set it up well enough, I thought, in that they showed her before getting cigarettes out of the glove compartment.
And him hastily closing the glove compartment before. They'd shown that, yeah, and plus it's clear that she runs that family, so I didn't really have a problem with that either.
So I get what you're saying, Dingus, and I want to talk more about that. So Kelly Wand, overall, you liked it because you're an Anglophile, and it was quiet and mannered,
and a pedophile. Ruined. Sorry. Anyway,
well, so here, I don't have a smooth way to segue this, but here's part of why I was really interested in watching it, is it raised issues. Like, so many of these May-December romances are just sort of glib, just romances. And this raised interesting issues for me about our perspective about sexuality in minors today versus in 1961.
Yeah, and the naivety of parents.
The naivete, but however, there was this structure set up around this girl to protect her, and it included, and I loved little bits of this, and this is because Lynn Barbara was writing a memoir about growing up in 1961. You know, there was a structure around her, like her teachers noticed. I loved seeing that, you know, this was a different society. And I also liked, have either of you guys seen a movie called Blue Car with Agnes Bruckner and David Strathairn?
No.
It's very much the same kind of movie. It came to the film festivals. It's about a young girl who's into, she wants to write poetry. And David Strathairn is her English teacher, and it's a May-December romance. But it ends up being just really just glib and convenient, and David Strathairn basically, like, rapes her. You know, it's sort of like we have to make this guy the bad guy to show that, a woman can't date a guy who's like twice his age. That's not a functional relationship. So the shorthand way to do this is we make him a rapist. And that, by the way, is the opposite of the casting spoiler with Peter Sarsgaard, is when you cast David Strathairn, it's an understanding, sort of wiser, older, sensitive guy. But, oh, he's a rapist in Blue Car. So here, I thought it was interesting that in order to show that this relationship can't work, they make him married, they make him basically a thief, you know, a ne'er-do-well, kind of lovable, but still a ne'er-do-well. But along the way, they've created this, it looks to all intent, it looks like a functional relationship. Like, you get the sense that it could have worked if he wasn't a thief and if he wasn't married. And I'm a little bit interested in the movie seems to approve of a 35-year-old dating a 16-year-old.
Yeah, and she would have married him.
Right, she would have married him, and this would have been an older couple where, you know, he's 60 and she's 45 and nobody thinks anything of it and they've been married all these years. You know, it could have been something like that. So was that a function of 1961? Is that something that bothers you guys in a movie? What did you guys think about that? This idea that it didn't necessarily look disapprovingly on a 16-year-old and a 35-year-old in a relationship.
Well, I thought it did for the reasons you said, like it stacked the deck against him, so it wasn't really approving of the relationship.
Right.
It just made her.
But so you talk about the screenwriter and you, Kelly Wand. Watching that, I sort of think, well, that's a contrivance. They have to introduce that to sort of disapprove of the relationship.
Yeah, and the fact they have to make him like an actual thief who steals stuff from houses.
Right.
In real life, it was apparently a little more complicated. He was sort of like a real estate scammer, and it was sort of less cinematic. And she never would have married him. She was like really sullen with him, and she really enjoyed being with his friends more. And they didn't really bond over anything.
I have to say, though, I honestly could not care less about, like, the real-life story. I'm sort of more interested in the movie that I'm going to screw up her name. Soderfig. She's a Danish director. Hold on, I want to look at it because I meant.
Well, her name is Lone. I don't know how you would say Lone. I don't know how you'd say her name.
Lone. I don't know.
Lone Scherfig.
Right. Yeah, I'm more interested in the story that she told using Nick Hornby's script. Was there this more European sensibility about relationships like that? I don't know if that's the case too.
Well, everything's class based. And I think you were right. I think it was a good, I mean, when you said it was about issues, like it was about how that kind of society, which I think is still true. But
I think that also partly
reduced. A guy with a suit comes into your house, a stranger, but he's wearing such a nice suit. You go, that's the best thing that could happen to my daughter.
And I think that also partly redeems Alfred Molina's character. You know, Dingus, you're talking about being uncomfortable with that. But I think, like Kelly is saying, that is a facet of 1961 London. I didn't know the neighborhood names, but obviously there was this sense that she was in the crappy neighborhood, and it's supposed to be a big reveal that he's just living around the corner. He's from the same neighborhood. And that was something that, you know, that's not something that I have any life experience with. So I enjoyed that aspect of it, you know, seeing a movie set in 1961 with a whole different sensibility about that.
Right, and I didn't get that. I didn't understand that early in the movie, when in that first scene where he comes in and he's you know saying I want to take your daughter out and the parents just acquiesce. I didn't understand a lot of those layers, so that what you're describing, Tom, seemed very insidious to me and very interesting as well. How the film was basically just asking us to assume this is okay. He drives up. He's sort of protective of her. You can stand outside the car, put your cello in it. He's very charming. He seems very safe. And I realize, okay, we're getting into a relationship here, and the film is basically just asking for us to think this is okay. And it's not like one of these things where it's hidden and we're going to sneak around, and then sometime late in the film it's going to, oh, no, she's with an older man. It's everything is about, everything is on the table. I'm an older man. I'm here to date your daughter. Okay, you may. It was so weird and insidious and interesting, and I love the way you asked that question, Tom, because I don't know what the film is – if the film is asking us to approve of that or not, but it made me think of very interesting questions, especially having been somebody not only who is a parent now but who has taught ninth graders, freshmen in high school – And had to sort of understand the whole deal of being a young male teacher with young girls around him. And it was a very strange thing to see that dynamic develop in a film that was basically just seeming to say, this is fine, just accept it.
Except for the fact that he's a ne'er-do-well and he's married. Because
which he, which he becomes later on. But at the beginning, it seems like it's just, accept this. This is going to be normal.
Right.
I think the movie was ambivalent about whether it was okay or not, or
well, before he becomes like now, how do you say that? Because I would love for that to have been the case. I mean, as an adult, I have a serious problem with that. Like, I don't want to get all Dr. Laura here, but I think that that's incredibly dysfunctional and it's damaging for a 16-year-old. Like, I as the movie
it is, but you know what?
Hold on.
Okay.
As the movie's unfolding, and I'm sitting there as an audience member with my own baggage watching it, I'm very uncomfortable, and I'm thinking, I don't approve of this. I don't like what these characters are doing, but I want to sit here and watch you explore it. And so by the time that it takes this convenient out of only disapproving of it because he's married and because he's a thief, I was like, well, that was cheap. I mean, this isn't...
It didn't make a good case for Oxford.
That was their agenda.
You hate Latin. Well, your boyfriend's married and has a kid, so Latin's better than that, right?
So, but it brings to mind other, like, you know, I think of Blue Car, which I don't necessarily recommend. But you can also look at things like last year's The Reader, you know, the horrible thing where relationship was okay because, A, he was a dude, but she was a Nazi, so that's why it was wrong, not because she was older than him. But I'm trying to think, and it's why I recommended to you guys a short story called The Smoker, which is in The New Yorker. Which I think has a very different take on, and I'm trying to look up the guy's name. Dingus, do you remember the author's name?
Sorry, no.
Well, anyway, so that's a short story that it's about similar subject matter, and I think has a. Anyway, so are there other movies that you can think of that sort of realize that an American audience watching this, not even necessarily an American audience, but some people watching this might be uncomfortable with that age disparity and what that does to her development as a young girl?
First of all, the author's name is David Schick. Second of all, this, I don't know if this is going to work for anybody, but have you seen a film called Beautiful Girls?
Yeah, Natalie Portman's a breakthrough role.
Right. Tom?
I have not, no.
All right. It's not. There's not much to recommend in the film. It's not very good, I don't think. But no. there's this incredible relationship that Natalie Portman and Timothy Hutton have. And it's very much at arm's length, but there's this weird sort of tension there and this beautiful – It's just an interesting relationship that has the potential to go too far, but has a weird sort of mentor quality to it, but a sexual tension as well, and that is, I think, more the American sensibility realized rather than this film.
And it's Natalie Portman.
It's Natalie Portman, and it's a whole ensemble. It's most famous because it's got Rosie O'Donnell having a ridiculous rant about Playboy models.
And, like, think of Natalie Portman and
in The Professional,
right?
Oh, gotcha. Well, good. I didn't even think of that. I think this is before
and
that.
And Portman and Jake Lloyd in Phantom Menace, another disparity.
Nice. But she's a child in this film, but there's this weird kind of thing going on, and it's very interesting. Excuse me.
I don't know what audiences or Americans think about things, because I don't really care about that stuff, but from personal experience, she grows as a person through all this. So even when you're 16 and something horrible happens to you like this, it made her stronger. And she, never mind, you just don't want to hear about the memoir anymore. But well, there were good and bad sides to what had happened.
That also works in the movie, Kelly Wand, because the movie very clearly is she breaks away from this. And that's another thing that was very neat and pat. Once she finds out that she's married, we get a two-scene study hard montage where we get
that she doesn't like. She's like, ugh.
We get the convenient, the one school teacher plays it real and doesn't accept her back in the school. And Olivia Williams is like, yes, I wanted you to say that. And then she gets the letter, you know?
Where the heck did that come from? And that's when I really broke with the movie. And this is when I'm going to get angry, because that whole montage and then a letter from Oxford. Suddenly, God, so quickly. Where did that letter from Oxford? What the heck?
Dear madam, we saw your montage. And
seriously, I mean, it really felt like, oh boy, we haven't read. Guys, we got to wrap up the film.
and that's what, you know, I mean, there was no sense of, yes, she just very conveniently became sort of strong. I mean, she's already sort of adult and smart, but she very conveniently came out of the other end of this. And that's another thing that I was disappointed at, because as a relationship, they had built it up. Like, it was functional. He really cared for her, too. Yeah. And she for him, and it seemed like they improved each other. Like he was introducing her to new things, and she obviously stimulated him.
Well, he dumped her, though. That's what ended it.
Well, I think he...
No, he didn't dump her. He was a coward.
Exactly. And it's the Peter Sarsgaard casting spoiler, is that you know he's going to do that.
And so. I disagree that there was a relationship going on here in the way that you're suggesting, Tom, because what I thought... in particular, after the banana joke scene, mm-hmm. when he says, let's try a banana to get through the messy part, and she says, I don't want to lose my virginity to a piece of fruit. Right. And you have this wonderful little scene where they're sitting on the little couch in the suite.
Yes.
And it feels like there's a friendship here. It feels like where we're going is we've gone past that moment where we thought we were going to be sexual. That moment was broken. And now we're being friends, and we're sort of – it's clear that she's the adult in the relationship, because he suggested using a piece of fruit, and she said, well, you kind of ruined the moment. Let's do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's got this sort of this vibe that I felt it was going to be more of a mentor or more of a friendship going forward, and I thought that's where the movie was going to go. But instead, it lapses back into this weird sort of awkward sexuality where she then gets to make a joke about how short it lasted, and he just sort of shrugs that off.
Yeah, he's a bad lay.
That's all you see of the sexuality, and that's...
Yeah, I disagree, Dingus. The scene where she is in the nightgown, and he says, can I just see your breasts? I mean, I forget what he says, but and then he puts her nightgown back on. I thought that was very sexual, and it said a lot about their relationship.
That was
taking advantage of her, that he really cared for her, and that it wasn't some dirty old man kind of thing.
No, I agree, but that was before what I'm talking about, wasn't
right.
it?
Yeah.
And I think that says more about him. He's not looking for sex. He's looking for the one. He even says that.
Yeah, he calls her the one. That's how women talk, isn't it?
I think he's constantly looking for the one. He loves falling in love. He loves being in love. And I think the things that Sally Hawkins says later lead you to think that this has happened many, many times. And he loves being in love, and he's looking for the one that he will fall in love with.
Oh, my God, that was Sally Hawkins. Oh, thank you, Dingus. I meant to look her up. I was like, I know who that is. Awesome.
Oh, yeah. That was another scene I didn't like, because she goes to see the wife, and then at the end she goes, oh, at least you're not in a family way, and then Carrie Mulligan starts to run away, and then the mom, the wife, goes, no, stay. What? Why would she invite her to stay with her?
And still, I can't get over that was Sally Hawkins, though. Awesome. I completely sidetracked this. I'm sorry.
Who the hell's Sally Hawkins?
Did you not see Happy Go Lucky?
No.
Oh, you need to. She's a phenomenal actress. I mean, it's her. It's a Mike Lee movie, and you know, Mike Lee with a good actor is just, there's nothing like it.
Writing it down.
Which unfortunately distracted me, and I couldn't help but think, boy, yeah. I'd really rather find out what her story is than this. I mean, I love her so much. And when she came walking out of the house, and they have such a weird doppelganger thing going on, and she's with a kid, and she does that, you're not in the family wear, because that's happened before. I got this feeling of David being the guy who just wants to fall in love. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, but all of that, though, Dingus, is stuff that they lay. It's why I'm saying I sort of feel it's a cop-out to conveniently layer that on after the fact. Because until we know that stuff, it does seem like a functional, constructive relationship between two people as equals who care about each other. And it's only later I feel like it kind of cheats by not really exploring the problems of a 16-year-old girl dating a 35-year-old man.
Which is why I don't see how you can use the word equals when you say that statement.
Well, that's because I'm talking about the movie's fiction and what I think I wanted them to explore. You know, the movie's fiction didn't have to do with the fact that a 16-year-old girl is still developing. She's very susceptible. She's very impressionable. A 35-year-old man should be an adult. You know, none of those issues really came up until the very end when it's a convenient reveal that he's married and that he's a thief. But if it wasn't for those two things, it would have worked out fine.
I don't know about that. I think they came up.
Well, you didn't feel like ever, like...
It was just ignored by the parents. It wasn't ignored by the teachers or her girlfriends. They were like, oh, get a load of...
well, the teachers disapproved, but the girlfriends didn't disapprove. And I don't think there was one brief moment where...
Because he was older.
Right. But what does the movie... How does the movie disapprove of their age difference? I don't think it does. It disapproves of him being married.
Casting Peter Sarsgaard.
It disapproves of him being a thief. It very briefly flirts, and I didn't know if there would be more of this.
He lies a lot.
It very briefly flirts with him being insecure about her... and his buddy, and also liked the scene where he is trying, it seems like almost out of that insecurity, he proposes to her. They go out into the parking lot, opens the trunk, and he's fumbling around looking for a ring, and this was a whole different character. You know, I would have much rather they explored this character than just conveniently thrown in a wife. Where he's
just getting interesting, and then he's out of
yeah, it. Exactly. He's insecure, and he's frantic, and he's a little bit pathetic and sad, and the timing is off, and he's not as charming.
She's out of his league. And she's like only 16.
Yeah, and I sort of was like, okay, now we're going to get into something about why this relationship, you know, obviously a 35-year-old man should not be dating a 16-year-old girl, and now we're about to find out why. Oh, no, we're not. We're just going to find out that he was married.
Well, if he'd written a memoir, then it would have been. But so did I like the movie more than you guys? Because I seem to... You guys kind of ruined it for me just now.
Well, no, no. Okay, so here's how I would salvage it.
Good points and your smart talk.
I think you both liked it more than I did.
Yeah, so
but I felt for her. I'm really dumb when I see a pretty face.
Well, here's why I like it. I thought she was phenomenal, and I was thinking child actor, but now that she's 24, that doesn't really count. But she was great. I really liked Peter Sarsgaard. I liked the setting, and I liked the alternative take on... you know, a coming of age for a girl in 1961 rather than modern day like June.
Yeah, it was a good period piece. And it felt historically authentic.
And I quite appreciated that. You know, here's the thing. It was good to see a coming of age movie about a girl who's into like Latin and Elgar and existentialism and the cello rather than, you know, a girl who's into, I don't know, whatever chicks are into these days. Like Juno, where she's into like punk music and Dario Argento, even though that's totally unrealistic.
But that's period for now. I mean, why is that any different?
What's period for now?
I mean, Juno is period now, and no, she's period then.
Juno's not period now. There's no chicks that age who are into Dario Argento.
Oh, okay, you're right.
I mean, Juno really is it's Diablo Cody's memoir, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But it's just they don't really play it as a memoir.
It's her revisionism, it's Lynn Barber's revisionism.
So I like that. I also liked, and Dingus, I know you'll share this with me, and Kelly Wand, I'll be curious, you know, you've been talking about how hot Carey Mulligan is. I think no matter how hard they try to frump up Olivia Williams, it does not work. Oh, my God. I mean, I don't know if it's just thinking of her in Rushmore or but even with those severe glasses on and her hair back, I was like, no, you guys aren't fooling me. She's really hot. I like her.
I like her too, but that last scene made me so annoyed because this is all you're going to give her to do. She's going to go make tea and say
she's the Deus Ex Machina of the movie.
Seriously, I was waiting for you to say that.
Really? Seriously? And Emma Thompson too. What a waste of her. I mean,
exactly. How did they get these people to do this?
So do you guys know who Kara Seymour is?
No, I wish.
You recognize her? So I also loved how much she and Carey Mulligan looked alike. She played the mother. And she's from...
I loved her, actually.
So you've seen her in Hotel Rwanda as a UN worker. I think she's most memorable as the girlfriend in Adaptation, who Nicholas sort of failed.
She had to do some subtle stuff in the movie, and she's not in it very much, but she makes a lot of the little she's in.
Yeah. And there were times where I was like, wow.
I believed in her character. But when Doc Ock's your dad, I guess you're always going to have issues role model-wise.
So for those reasons, I quite like So I Kelly?
You mean the movie or her?
The movie. Her. You know, for the script, the actors, I think those were...
I liked it because it was quiet and it just sort of ended. I mean, it didn't end sensibly and it didn't make any sense. It wasn't good. But I liked the quietness of the bad ending, if that makes any sense. Like, he just disappears.
They had actually, Wikipedia says they had shot an alternate ending with the classic, you know, Annie Hall ending where they meet again.
they met again in real life, which I know you're interested in.
only if you say...
a friend.
If you say RL, I'll listen to you.
In RL, they hung out, her and her boyfriend, at this restaurant because he kind of stalked her at Oxford for a little bit. And then after the dinner, the boyfriend went to her. Yeah, I can see why you like him. He's awesome. And then she got mad at the boyfriend.
So, Kelly Wand, did you read this Lynn Barber memoir?
Yeah, maybe that's what makes the movie more interesting to me.
Why did you?
Even though I hate biopics and somehow the biopic element. Like, if it hadn't been a biopic, maybe...
Did you read it before you saw it?
No.
Oh, so that's why you read it, is you saw the movie and then you were like, I want to read the source material.
Yeah, because it's short.
Oh, all right, wow.
And I was curious and the last line of her memoir is, if you guys want to think that I'm as pretty as Carey Mulligan, 16, by all means, go ahead.
That's not true. You made that up.
No, that's what she says.
It's so not in there.
She ends it. She ends with lust for Carey Mulligan.
One thing I quite liked, what is it about the Danish and filmmaking? There are so many awesome... So the woman who directed this is Danish. She did this movie called Italian for Beginners, which I've never seen. I think of it as sort of a light romantic comedy. I'm not really interested. But why are there so many good Danish filmmakers? What's up with that?
Because it's cold.
They got nothing better to do but make movies. And how come there aren't any great, like, Finnish filmmakers?
That's not true.
There's one.
Is Amsterdam Danish? I forget.
Amsterdam is Dutch. They're the Netherlands. So Denmark.
Is cheese Danish?
I'm sure they have their types of cheese, yes.
I'm going to, you know, I like your question, Tom, but there are things about this movie that I don't think are very well made, and I don't know. I mean, there are things about the direction that I really did not like. I mean, technical things I really did not like, so I don't know if I can go with you.
Besides the lighting during the rain?
Besides the lighting during the rain. And I don't know that you can pin the music on the director, but the music was...
I knew you were going to say that.
It was just it was overbearing. Yeah. It was overbearing, and it was like they asked Clint Eastwood to come in and go ahead and make the soundtrack. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't as bad as his stuff, but it was inappropriate. It was too loud, and
Your Wagon's awesome. First off,
it was completely overbearing. But there were also a lot of obvious and awkward and self-aware camera moves that kept jarring me and making me think, why are you moving the camera there? And also edits that made me think, why are you editing there? There's two in particular that really annoyed me, or three. There's when I apologize for this sort of being pedantic about this, but it was so obvious to me and just leapt out of the screen at me. When they're going on the date with the parents, when they're first driving to the gas station, they're driving along the river, and the camera's showing the car driving away, and the camera just drifts off to the right into the trees.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, there's somebody over there with a sniper rifle or something. And then we just cut to the gas station.
No, it's symbolic of her mind drifting.
Yeah, it was symbolic of me wanting to leave all of a sudden.
You're not getting the Aronofsky-isms.
And then there's the moment, and this made me think of In Treatment. There's this moment where the moment after he proposes to her, he's looking for a ring. I thought I had a ring. Will you marry me? And there's this awkward moment. And in so many movies and television shows, they just cut away from that rather than forcing the characters to resolve the moment. And they did this weird sort of jump cut away from them in a low angle. And she said, just take me home. And I'm like, are you going to answer, or is the scene going to resolve at all?
Yeah, what happens in the car on the way home? Is there more talk of this?
And the reason I bring up In Treatment is this: it's this wonderful television show where the characters are forced to resolve every issue, or at least talk through everything. We're not going to cut away to something else. And then there's this, and this is the last one I'll hold forth on. It's when she's leaving school after that awful scene with Emma Thompson, and she's running out, dragging her bag behind her, and her little girlfriends run out to peek around the corner. And it's the shot from a cloud or from another building with the swelling music. Why are we up there?
I know that sequence, that scene, Dingus, and I think what we're seeing there is she runs out into the street and leaves, and her friends run behind her, and they stop right at the line of the school gate and lean out and watch her. So I think there's this sensibility that she's breaking free of that world, and her friends, it's almost like there's a police line or something. They can't cross it. I mean, it's this weird thing where the schoolgirls surge out with her, and they won't cross that invisible barrier that moves them out into the real world from the school.
They're trapped behind Emma Thompson's fence.
But I know what you're talking about, but I think that's what was going on there.
So that's another drift to trees shot, is what he's saying, right?
I just think it was a conspicuous, the director thought it would be cool to sort of show her leaving the school and the other girls sort of stopping at this invisible wall between the school and the real world.
And the word you just chose, conspicuous, is the perfect word. Because that's what I constantly felt, is as opposed to something like I don't know, Notes on a Scandal or something, where I never felt like You know, I seem to remember feeling the same way about Sense and Sensibility, and I liked the movie a lot, but I kept feeling like the camera was constantly in a character in the movie. And I felt like that in this movie, and I haven't felt like that in other movies. And if I feel like the camera is intruding and conspicuous, as you just said, I'm not going to be able to go along with the director.
Okay. Notes on a Scandal, by the way, another interesting take on that sort of May-December romance. Kelly Wan, right. Have you seen Notes on a Scandal?
Yeah, I liked it. It was Highsmithy, Patricia Highsmithy.
She didn't write that, though, did she?
No, but it felt a little Highsmithy.
Okay.
it's the one where Judi Dench is evil and Cate Blanchett sleeps with the underage student.
Well, spoiler.
Oh, what? It's like the first shot.
That, by the way, has one of my favorite, like, half-second moments of acting. Where Judi Dench really, really wants something, and the moment she gets it, she can't react to it because of who she's talking to and what they do and don't know. And she's got this wonderful half-second flicker of elation across her face before she swallows it and delivers. She's just amazing. But anyway, so thumbs up for me and Kelly Wand. And Dingus, would you say you didn't like An Education?
I'm reluctant to, because I know it has 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, so that makes me the only guy who didn't like it.
The only guy who didn't fall for Carey Mulligan.
But I would really love to hear – I would love to have a woman here to talk about especially the elements of feminism in this movie that just felt so heavy-handed and obvious. And I'm just wondering why everybody's falling for this movie and thinking it's just the cat's pajamas, and I just can't.
I think it's
and I just so wanted to love it, and I just kept trying to make myself love it, and I kept giggling at little parts. But
I think it's because of Carey Mulligan. It's because of the setting. It's a good period piece, and Peter Sarsgaard. Like, I think it's just good performances and a sort of a good overall script and setting. I think
this is all it needs. That's all it needs to be successful.
Yeah. There you go. It's no The Reader.
How dare you?
I didn't see that because it starts with the, which to me, I don't see movies that start with the.
You just see movies that start with an indefinite article.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good policy.
Right. 1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart,
so it is now time for this week's 3x3. Kelly Wand, I believe the task has fallen to you to assign us a list of three movies to think of. What was your topic this week?
Wait, I have to assign you, or I have to explain what I assigned last week?
You have to tell us, yeah, you have to, because people might not.
Do I have to explain what 3x3 means? Can you just go to the other podcasts and listen to that part?
Yeah, I think folks probably know by now.
It's three movies that we came up with each about something, some dumb topic, and no one wins anything. And the topic last week.
Why are you calling it a dumb topic? We've had some very good topics.
This one's mine, and I feel it was my B side.
Well, why?
It panned out. It panned out. Don't sell yourself short.
Okay. I'm just selling my own list short, then, maybe. Mine's kind of repetitive.
Next time, pull out your A side material.
Well, I want to keep doing these, so we have to grow into the quality work.
I don't know about you guys, but like as I'm going through the week, I'm constantly thinking of things for this. So I don't.
I
have no shortage of material. So what did you come up with us? What did you come up with for us, Kelly?
My topic for 3x3 this week was three quote classic movies, or I would say any movies that everyone's seen basically, except you. Mm-hmm. And why you didn't see that movie. Okay. Like, what about it? Did you, I'm not falling for Wizard of Oz. Not that that's mine, but it's that's one of the answers. Right, it's Tom's number one. Who starts? What are the rules of this?
Is it Dingus, you start because you're introducing this week?
Right, I have to start because I'm introducing.
Okay, what's your number three?
All right, my number three classic movie that I haven't seen and why is a film called Birth of a Nation. Have you guys ever heard of this movie?
No one's seen it because they never show it.
Exactly. Nobody has seen that, so.
It's a movie where it's racist propaganda, but it's good because it's old.
Now, why haven't you seen it, though?
All right, go ahead, you guys. Then you go next.
Well, could you have seen it and then you're like, I'm not watching it. I'm just going to shut my eyes during the silent movie while you guys all watch it.
Yeah, that's right. I did listen to it.
It's got a good soundtrack. That must be Debbie Griffith's best.
I'm going to guess that Kelly Wand had. So you've seen Birth of a Nation?
I can't remember.
I sure
have that answer. I want to, and I think people should see. I think it's a historical document, and that everything, anything goes. I think you should always be allowed to see what was written during. I mean, it's a time capsule.
Is it on Blu-ray?
I don't know. Do I have to look that up right now?
I'm not going
to
see it if it's not on Blu-ray. I don't watch standard analog.
Did you see Intolerance, his other big thing? His other 19.
I can't stand that movie.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Birth of a Nation is only available on UMD, actually.
Awesome. Can't wait to watch that on my PSP. All right. And Digus, do you watch
it? And it's also on Steam.
Wait, Tom, did you say you had seen it?
No, good Lord, no. Why would I watch that?
Right, really? Neither of you have any interest in seeing Birth of a Nation.
You know what? I got that out of my system when I watched that, what's that Leni Riefenstahl thing?
And that's exactly what I was going to talk about.
You know, what is that movie?
Triumph of the Will.
Right. I did my term of service for historical documents, historical documents.
But I just like anything from that era. Like, I like seeing what movie sets look like in the 1910s and what people considered entertainment then, and all these people are dead now. Just with the facial structure. I mean, it's the earliest moving picture you have of anyone. I don't know. It's like refusing to look at statuary. That's what you guys are doing. You sicken me.
I will listen to statuary, but I will not look at it.
Well, the soundtrack was D.W.
Well, Tom, what I was going to say is that exactly what you just alluded to about Triumph of the Will is that I insisted that a bunch of us watch Triumph of the Will.
Oh my God, that's right. It's your fault I watched that thing.
That's absolutely right. And all of you said, why? And I said, because it's a classic. Hello. And then you all said Nazis. And we watched it, and it turned out to be just boring. And
but isn't that instructive to find out that Triumph of the Will is boring? Like, it's the suppressed, like, oh, can't see Triumph of the Will, it'll corrupt. And then when you see it, you go,
if I want to watch a boring movie, I'll get some Gus Van Sant thing or something. I'd rather watch a modern boring movie.
What? You don't like to die for?
The point is, I don't think slogging through it is worth it. Yeah. I actually sort of delved into this because your topic, Kelly, gave me a great deal of trouble this week. Having so much trouble, but then it really paid off as I really started to look into why haven't I seen this film in particular. I started thinking about Citizen Kane and how everybody talks about how great that is. And it took me so many, I'm talking double digit viewings of Citizen Kane before I started to understand what the point is or what's so great about it. And I'm not sure I care, to be honest, but I'm starting to understand now. And I think the problem with something like Birth of a Nation is that I don't know that it's worth that investment, given the fact that I'm going to be watching something about the Klan, to watch 10, 12 times until I understand, oh, well, this is why this is a great film. This is why this deserves to be in the pantheon of great films. This is,
you know what?
What?
It's topical.
Does.
You should watch it now because it's going down.
Well, certainly, but I just didn't know if I wanted to put in that kind of investment. Whether or not it teaches me about great film, or whether or not it teaches me about evil, or whatever it teaches me about, I just know that if I'm really going to understand the film, I'm going to have to watch it a few times, and I know I'm not going to want to do that.
Dingus, you have seen Citizen Kane double-digit numbers of times?
And then liked it.
Well, no, I didn't say I liked it. I've seen it many times. I've seen it in theaters.
You don't like it? Not even on a visual level? It doesn't hook
you? There are things I like about it, but it took
me
a long time.
It's not about interesting. Yeah.
It took me a long time to understand what the fuss was.
Well, you're much more dedicated than me, because I've seen Citizen Kane probably once when I was in high school, and I just said, okay, whatever.
I went to a theater to see it with a friend the first time I saw it in New York, and I was just sitting there going, why am I – and it wasn't until I started to really read about, well, this is what was being done then, and this is what couldn't have been done then, and this is why you should like this film, that I started to understand, oh, well, they couldn't even do that then, and this is why it's such a great film.
Right. All right. Well, that's your number three.
I highly recommend the double feature Triumph of the Will and then Showa.
They kind of even each
next
other
party
out.
Party night. Yeah, on Thanksgiving, you guys should whip those out.
Well, my number three was my number one, but I'm going to move it up to my number three because I'm afraid Kelly Wand is going to also pick it. I've never seen Wizard of Oz, and the reason I've seen it is because it's
I totally ruined that. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I haven't seen it because it's for kids, right? Like, it's some kid movie.
It's a cartoon.
I've met other people who haven't seen it. I'm always stunned. Like, you just didn't accidentally see it when you were a kid.
You know, I may have Kelly Wand, and I've certainly absorbed everything from it through just cultural osmosis. Like,
dude,
I read the books.
Right,
but I know about the flying monkeys and the man behind the curtain and the yellow brick road, like all of those things. Actually, I don't, like, I know that, what is it? So One Flew Over the, no. Is it one, not One Flew Over the Rainbow? Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That's what I'm thinking.
Under the Rainbow. It's under the rainbow.
Isn't that, that's from Wizard of Oz, right?
One Flew Over the Rainbow.
The Chevy Chase movie with Carrie Fisher.
So I know all about Wizard of Oz. I just haven't actually seen it since I'm old enough to...
You haven't seen the Pink Floyd version?
Of Wizard of Oz, no.
Yeah, where the guy listens to.
Oh, that's right. Dark Side of the Moon, you're supposed to set.
There's also a version where it's each word in Wizard of Oz alphabetically. Have you ever seen that?
No.
There's tons of just...
No, I haven't even seen the regular movie, so I haven't, yeah.
Did you see Godfather yet?
Oh, yeah, no, I've seen all the Godfather movies. Please, what are you taking me for? It's these older classics that I just have a hard time with. So that's my number three. Now, here's the thing. I don't anymore because I got rid of all my VHS tapes. But for a while, I owned a couple of copies of it because I would tell people, hey, I've never seen Wizard of Oz. And like, oh, well, you got to watch it. Here, take my copy. And then I would forget who loaned it to me, and it was a VHS anyway. So
that meant they didn't want it.
I think that, well, they really wanted me to see it, so they gave me the copy. And
I predict your number two is Gone with the Wind, because you hate everything made in 1939.
I've seen Gone with the Wind. I like Civil War movies. I think, and I'm not joking about this, I think didn't Wizard of Oz just come out on Blu-ray?
I don't know. I don't have a PS3.
Okay. Well, I do want to see it at some point. It's just not a priority.
This isn't a Blu-ray podcast.
But I'm a Blu-ray guy. So there you go. So that's my number three.
I know what to get you for Christmas.
There you go. Because I also sort of subconsciously think, you know, it's for kids.
Do you have it on Betamax?
I have it on 8-track.
Nice.
It's kids and stoners. So I've seen it all my life, basically.
What's your number three, Kelly Wand? What classic have you not seen and why?
This is my weakest one. So it's probably not even really a classic movie by anyone's standards, but I've never seen Ghost. With Patrick Swayze, the late.
Wasn't
that Best Picture or something? Or
that is awesome that you brought that up, because I was going to ask at the beginning of this if Dirty Dancing could be considered a classic.
I've not seen Dirty Dancing.
Me neither. So good.
Dude,
for
I saw,
you.
I saw
good for
the
you,
theater.
Ghost. Nice. Ghost was nominated for Best Picture, wasn't it?
No, I don't know.
Whoopi Goldberg won an Oscar for it, and they went, hey, do you believe in ghosts? And she went, I believe in the back end, honey.
Is that your Whoopi Goldberg impression?
Yeah, that's how I do.
Now, why haven't you seen Ghost, Kelly Wand?
I don't like movies about ghosts with guys from Dirty Dancing in them. It just isn't a combination.
Are there any ghosts in Roadhouse?
I saw Roadhouse because it wasn't about ghosts in Patrick Swayze. It was just
There are goats in Roadhouse though.
There's guys who stare at the goats.
Is Roadhouse a classic? Because I've never seen Roadhouse.
No. What are you talking about?
All right, well, then I'm going to scratch.
How is that a classic?
If Ghost is a classic, then Roadhouse surely is a classic.
I don't think Ghost is a classic, and it should be on this list, and I'm an idiot. So should I do an alternate?
No, you only get three. We're going on to Dingus. Dingus, what's your number two classic that you've
Chicago.
Made? And why?
Why don't I think we should just have Kelly guess what ours are going to be, and then have that be it.
Well, you're an enigma wrapped in a riddle, wrapped in a tortilla to me. Like, I really don't know what you're going to say next, and that's one of my favorite things about you, Dingus. I really can't predict you, Tom. I can smell. I know what's
I'm
going
pretty
on.
Obvious. I know.
Yeah, Wizard of Oz. I said it before he said it, so obviously. Whatever I say as a joke will be Tom's real answers. Star Wars.
My number two is A Room with a View.
I haven't seen that thing.
Yeah, I've seen it and forgot about it.
Even though it starts with an indefinite article. It's not that title. It's an Ian Forster, isn't it? One of those.
But it's Merchant Eyrie, but it's not the room with a view. So I would think you'd be okay because it's a room with a view.
I know. That was before I made my rule.
And I keep meaning to see this. I remember it coming out. I remember so many friends of mine saying it's to die for, and I really keep meaning to see it.
Is that how your friends talk?
That's how they talk. But every time I try to, I see that there's like this gentle impressionist painting of a poster in my head.
And I know. I feel exactly the same way. And there's something about the idea of going to a closed up theater and then seeing a movie called A Room with a View that rubs me the wrong way.
Rubs me the wrong way. It makes me go limp, whatever.
A Room with a View is just a window.
I don't know what I've been told it's just a fantastic film, but whenever I mention I haven't seen it, it's girls who say, "What?" And I've never had a dude say to me, "Seriously, you've got to see Room with a View."
Right.
It's one of those it sort of falls in this morass of those Merchant Ivory movies that I can't really tell one from the other. And the only one in that group that really stands out for me, which I can watch over and over again.
Howard's End. The one with the butler. Remains the Day. Yeah. That's a good one.
You guys have this covered. I don't even need to talk.
Is that what you were going to say, Tom?
You said, guess what you're going to say.
Remains of the Day is the Merchant. Like, I think that doesn't even count as Merchant Ivory. That is so good. I can watch that over and over and the performances and just how repressed and British it is.
Yeah.
For some reason that works, but I watch them being all repressed and British in Remains of the Day, or no, in Room with a View and Passage to India and all of those things, and I'm just like, yeah, whatever. So I don't know what that is. But, so Dingus, I don't even think as a fellow dude, I don't think you need to see Room with a View. Wait a minute, is Room with a View the one, speaking of nudity from last podcast, doesn't it have a bunch of dudes running around skinny dipping? Do you guys know, is that Room with a View?
That's Breaking Away.
I have no idea, but I think two people I really like are in it. I think Helena Bonham Carter are in it, and I think Daniel Day-Lewis is in it, but I haven't really looked yet. But I'm really interested in why you love Remains of the Day so much and these other movies.
Remains of the Day is, I think it's focused on, well, you know what? I don't know. I think part of it's performances. Part of it is how focused it is just on two characters. Part of it is how focused it is on this one aspect of British society. It's not the privileged. You know, it's not about the snooty, idle rich. You know, and maybe it's because it's by a Japanese writer, isn't it? The novel's from a Japanese novel, I think.
Oh, you're right. I know you're right. Yeah.
So I think it's a whole different perspective on that traditional Merchant Ivory stuff. And with the two powerful performances, I can just watch that over and over again. Or Gosford Park, by the way. Like, I would rather watch Gosford Park than a Merchant Ivory thing, which is the same subject material.
I'd rather watch Remains of the Day.
I'm with you there, Kelly. Come over and we'll watch that.
That scene where she finds him reading the poetry.
Yeah.
And
it's not poetry. Do you remember what it is? It's a romantic novel.
It's a romantic novel,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. I forget the name.
It's beautiful. It's just some silly old romance. I think that might even be her line. It's just some silly old romance. He's just so vulnerable in that scene.
Yeah. That scene just breaks your heart.
Yeah. Let's talk about that instead.
I love that movie. I'm totally with you.
So, yeah, okay, so...
But I did see Howard's End, and it's not nearly as good.
So. That I lump in, yeah, with Room with a View and whatnot. So you guys tell me real quick, what movie is this line from? Are you ready? Imagine that I'm sitting in a theater, and I'm watching the screen for a moment. This isn't Ian Forster. All right, what was that?
Fish Called Wanda?
No.
Mars Attacks?
It's another May-December romance, but it's gay. Okay, but I'm saying it's blind. it's a gay May-December romance. And a guy sitting in the theater watching a movie, and he goes, "This isn't Ian Forster."
Bachelor Party.
Do you have to say gay May-December? Can't you just say gay December?
Did you say gay-cember?
It's a movie called Love and Death on Long Island with John...
Oh, yeah, Jason Priestley.
And he accidentally, he's like an author, and he stumbles into the wrong movie. He thinks he's going to see an Ian Forster adaptation, and he walks into some teen sex comedy and gets up in disgust, but before he can leave, he sees Jason Priestley on the screen and falls in love with him.
Yeah, and then stalks him.
And but it works out, if I recall.
It's just like an education, except with dudes.
There you go.
Is that your number two, Tom?
No, because I have seen Love and Death on Long Island.
Uh-huh.
Well
so,
done.
Is it my turn for my number two?
I believe it is.
I have not seen The Sound of Music, and the reason I have not is because I don't like musicals.
Ah, oh, you bastard.
Did I steal yours?
Yes, that was my number one. All right, I have to rewrite my whole list now. That was the first repeat we've ever had on this podcast.
Well, what's your number two then, Kelly?
Well, we wouldn't know that if you hadn't revealed. Spoiler, hello.
I hate musicals, like basically cabaret, anything. And Sound of Music has – there. It's about Nazis that having played video games for decades, like I just want to shoot Nazis. And so if they're singing, that's just two reasons to shoot them.
The reason, by the way, Kelly Wand, although Cabaret might be a musical, it's a very strange, disturbing musical.
All right, I
think you would enjoy Cabaret.
I like Moulin Rouge. That's a musical I like.
Yeah, we won't hold that against you.
Really? That makes me gay?
No.
I like Beat Your Wagon.
It just means you like movies that aren't that good.
No, Moulin Rouge is all right. I'll stand by that.
Kelly Wand, what's your number two movie then?
Before we go into that, okay. Is your objection to musicals across the board here?
Mostly. I mean, I like some, you know, like I like some Baz Luhrmann.
I hate Grease.
Not you.
I certainly like Hedwig and the Angry.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is Kelly, do you like Hedwig?
Wait, what?
Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Do you like that?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you would like it.
All right, I'll check it out. Wizard of Oz is a musical too, so.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Spoiler.
Kids musical. All right, Leon, what is your number two classic that you have not seen?
We should watch Sound of Music together and then do it on the podcast, since neither of us want to see it whatsoever. Ever. My number two is It's a Wonderful Life, which I think everyone's seen.
Yeah.
Literally everyone's
seen. Oh, yeah.
Seen. I really think I'm the only one.
It's like a quintessential Christmas movie, yeah.
Yeah, but isn't it just a Capra movie meets A Christmas Carol?
Yep.
That's why I didn't see it, because I go, well, I've read the Dickens thing. I don't need to see the Jimmy Stewart as Scrooge. I mean, it's the same story, right?
I think you could also just go see the Robert Zemeckis A Christmas Carol when it opens.
Yeah.
Oh, no, don't.
That's a good one, because that's one that that one is like Wizard of Oz.
That is a classic, right.
And like Wizard of Oz, it's hard to have not seen that.
I basically destroyed all our credibility, or mine, not that there was any.
Well, the thing is, these are like old movies for the most part, except your weird ghost thing. I mean, I think
Citizen Kane's great.
It's just hard to sort of go back and watch older movies that come from a different a whole different style. Some of them I like. I mean, there's some.
They're faster paced.
Casablanca and The Searchers. And
they're more dialogue-centric, so that's another reason you should like them more. The Searchers is good, too. Is that what you just said?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, like some of the older movies, even though they have some of those same conventions as older movies, are still timeless to me, and they still work. But I don't feel that way about It's a Wonderful Life, for instance. Yeah, I can take that or leave that. So.
All right. How many times have you seen it? Double digit?
No, just once. It's one of those I hadn't seen for a long time. I rented it. Didn't even watch it at Christmas. I mean, it was July or something.
Yeah, anything you have to watch at Christmas, that's another reason I've never seen it. Yeah. Oh, It's a Wonderful Life on at Christmas.
Yeah, get in the holiday spirit, Kelly Wand. Come on.
No, Christmas sucks. I hate it. I hate movies you're supposed to hate. If Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is not in it, it's not a movie.
All right, so are we down to our number ones, I believe? Dingus,
stole mine.
What is your number what? You can bring it back around. We'll come back and talk about it. Dingus, what is your number one classic you've never seen, and why?
My number one, and sorry, Kelly sort of ruins it with It's a Wonderful Life because it's right along those same lines thematically. It's a film called A Clockwork Orange.
Can we just hang up on Dingus right now?
You guys hate Kubrick.
No, we don't. Dingus does, well, Dingus isn't qualified to hate Kubrick because he has not seen A Clockwork Orange. God.
You know why he doesn't like it? Because he's a parent, and he doesn't like movies.
He doesn't even know anything about it, I bet. Dingus, have you not seen A Clockwork Orange?
Does it qualify as a classic?
Yes.
Hey, really?
By every measure. Every measure.
For a couple of reasons, Dingus. It's a pattern for a lot of movies. I think there are some movies that you can't really where you miss valuable things if you have not seen A Clockwork Orange. And I think that it's an absolutely just blazing performance from Malcolm McDowell. There's nothing. It's one of those things that it's like seeing Toshiro Mifune in Seven Samurai. I mean, it's one of those things where you're like, this guy is at the height of his craft. He's a genius, and it's captured on film. I just think Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange is like that. So you know what? In a way, Dingus, I'm a little jealous. I wish I could see Clockwork Orange for the first time again.
Well, then give me advice or help me, because when I was thinking about why you haven't seen something, this film is the perfect embodiment of this category and why I finally came to love this category. Thank you, Kelly Wand. Is that I don't know how to broach the topic of viewing this film because I'm scared of it. This is a film for which I've got years of residual shudders about it because of the things people have said or suggested. I don't know anything about it really, but whenever it's brought up, you just see people go, ugh.
Yeah. You know what though?
And so what I have to say is, how are you going to see it? Are you going to have a Clockwork Orange party? And,
yes.
And furthermore, would you want to be friends with someone who has a Clockwork Orange party?
Well, first of all, I would say
I want to be lovers.
I would say your reservations thing is it's fairly dated. It's not that shocking anymore.
Yeah.
You've seen Irreversible. Like it's nothing like that. It's fairly tame. Back in the day, yes, it was shocking.
I saw it as a kid and was not traumatized.
Yeah, like well.
Well, that might say that might have more.
That's true. I'm a bad example.
But it really is. So a couple of things. You know, it's really Kubrick at not his best, but he's really sharp with what he's doing. He's so focused. It's a great performance, and it's an awesome Anthony Burgess. I mean, it's from a novel, but it's an awesome script. The production design and the music are, I would say, iconic, and I don't use that word lightly. I mean, some of the visuals in Clockwork Orange are just unparalleled.
And the pacing of.
The pacing, yeah, it moves really well. It's not like sitting down to watch a slow movie.
It's like nothing else.
So I'm jealous.
You can see every movie that is like nothing else.
Yeah.
Well, here's part of the problem, and I'm going to get in real trouble because I've already complained about 2001. Sorry, Kelly Wand. I can't abide The Shining either.
There's none of that wankery. There's no Kubrick wankery like there is in The Shining and 2001.
The Shining is just so cheesy.
Right.
And
no, this is much more Strangelove Kubrick.
All right, well, that's what I needed to hear. But so how do I watch it? Do I watch it alone or do I watch it with friends?
Well, don't watch it with your wife. Wendy wouldn't like it. But
well, obviously.
Just rent it. Yeah.
Watch it with your kids.
It's nothing like weird. Like it's not like watching a porno or something. I mean, you could watch it with your friends, but you could also just like rent it and watch it on your own. It really is this whole thing about it being shocking. It's like The Exorcist. Like The Exorcist is still good and it holds up, but it's not necessarily going to make you sleep with the lights on anymore. And it's the same with the violence or whatnot, whatever you've heard about.
It taps into our fears of beds.
or San Diego.
So, all right. Well, that's a good one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
My number one is terrible. Like my number one, I've never seen. So this is an old movie, and this is an old movie that I kind of want to see, but the reason I haven't is because I got burned when I finally watched Jules and Jim, and that's Truffaut. I think it's just like these old European movies, but I really want to see The Bicycle Thief because I know it's Italian, it's not French. And I love those Italian existential movies, like the Antonioni stuff and La Ventura and Bertolucci, of course. So I think, and I might be wrong, but I think Bicycle Thief is sort of a predecessor to these. And I
thought it was French, so that's why I didn't see it.
Maybe it is. Isn't an Italian director, though?
Dingus will look it up for us because he's.
Well, it's not Truffaut. Like another one is like 400 Blows. I've never seen that, but I'm like, you know what? I don't need to see any more Truffaut. Truffaut's best work was the beginning of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, anyway.
As was Bob Balaban's.
Oh boy. So Bicycle Thief. Never seen it. Really want to. I just, you know, I'm still recovering from having to sit through Jules and Jim. So.
I've never seen Clute.
I haven't either.
Like Freaky Donald Sutherland and
Jane Fonda's Brandy
Fonda. The prostitute with the heart of gold kind of thing, I believe. I don't think I've seen it either. Clute's not classic. It's just one of those obscure, weird 70s things that you should see.
Midnight Cowboy's good, huh, guys? I haven't seen Million Dollar Baby. There's a lot of Oscar winners I haven't seen.
Don't bother.
Are you?
I didn't see Slumdog Millionaire.
Don't bother. Don't bother with Million Dollar Baby either.
Hmm. Anything with million in the title.
Anything with Clint Eastwood on the soundtrack.
Millions is Danny Boyle with James Nesbitt. Sort of a weird coming of age thing that you should maybe see. Maybe if you want to be a Danny Boyle completionist.
Nice.
So Kelly Wand, your number one was Sound of Music. Now, you did not tell us why. Is it because of the Nazis? Because you're used to shooting them in video games and you don't want them singing?
We had to sing those songs in music class in third grade. We had to sing Edelweiss. And I was like, there's a whole movie about this. Like any movie where this is like the most memorable. I just couldn't imagine a movie moment where that song would be sung and hold my attention simultaneously.
Dingus, have you seen Sound of Music?
Oh, yes. I've seen it on stage and on film.
Uh-huh.
Should me and Kelly Wand see it?
I'm like, oh. If I'd rather watch Caligula.
If you got a chick with you and you want to make out, why not?
What? You make out to Sound of Music? That's got Nazis in it. That's sick. You're a sick father.
That's a short step from making out during Schindler's List. That's weird.
Yeah, man. That's not cool. I thought I was offensive.
That's an episode of Seinfeld, ladies and gentlemen.
You know what, Kelly Wand? It sounds like you and I are being let off the hook for having not seen Sound of Music. That's what it sounds like to me.
No, he says it gets you women. That's what Dingus is trying to say.
That's a disclaimer, though. When I said, should we see it? And he just sort of offered that as a disclaimer. Oh, if you want to make out.
You don't need to see it, especially since both of you hate musicals. Let me just ask this. How do you both feel about West Side Story? Kelly Wand.
Too gay.
Tom Chick.
I quite like West Side Story.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, I haven't seen it, so that's my number one now.
West Side Story, Kelly Wand, is you obviously know, it's either Leonard or Elmore. I can't take knife fighting with singing. But it's Romeo and Juliet via Leonard Bernstein.
That's what I'm saying. I've read Romeo and Juliet. I don't need to see the swishy version of it.
All right.
Do they both die at the end?
Of course. Dingus, wait a minute. Does me liking West Side Story mean that I should see Sound of Music?
No, I'm just trying to assess how deep your hatred, your hatred of musicals goes.
He's apparently a softcore hater.
Yeah.
Sound Story. That's pretty hardcore.
Well, that's the thing, is like a lot of it's more like I was talked into seeing West Side Story by a girlfriend who was really into it, and she really liked it, so maybe it was a context thing, but...
Does Listomania count as a musical? Ken Russell's Listomania for musical lovers. Any Ken Russell?
Wow, Ken Russell.
Wait, get back to your date story.
Well, I'm just saying that I was like introduced to West Side Story by someone who I really cared about who was really into it, so I'm sure that... maybe one of these days I'll date someone who's really into Sound of Music, and then I can transition to being a Sound of Music fan like I am a West Side Story fan.
I think there's a lot of sweetness in Sound of Music, and there's obviously some beautiful music in it. It's a little stilted, and I don't think you're going to find anything you really care about in it.
Okay, all right.
It has a bunch of kids running from Nazis, and I guess they all live, right?
Spoiler.
Von Trapps. Oh. Mountains.
Well, yeah, there's all those great scenes that George Lucas stole for, Attack of the Clowns.
What are you talking about?
Hello.
He stole scenes for, like, there are riffs on Sound of Music in Attack of the Clones. Hello?
Ah,
Dingus just hung up on us.
Well, it's especially useful if you loved any of the George Lucas scenes from Attack of the Clowns.
Oh, why? There's no.
I totally understand what you're saying.
There's no. There are riffs on Sound of Music in Attack of the Clones.
Of course there are. There's this whole Top of the Mountain, the Hills Are Alive thing. It's beautiful.
Okay.
You can't properly understand the prequels unless you've seen Sound of Music. Get to work.
Will your 3x3 next week, which you have to introduce, will that involve George Lucas's homages to classic movies?
For some of you, it might.
Well, what do you got for us for next week? So we've Those are our
George Lucas and classic in the same sense.
There you go. So our next week's 3x3, introduced by you, Dingus. What do you got for us?
All right. This week's 3x3 is inspired by a question that my father asked me. My father was visiting me last week, and we often talk about films. And he, just out of the blue, he asked me this question. What are some movies you can watch again and again, say once a year, and not get tired of them? And this got me thinking about this summer. I spent the first summer.
That was totally a Dingus thing. Are you still here, Kelly Wan?
Yes.
What do you think?
Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
I thought that was the list. Things you could see.
It might be.
It's quite a setup.
It was a great setup. He had a little family thing, and I guess he just didn't. He gave us all the info we needed. So three movies that you can see over and over again.
Hello.
So we're predicting that it's three movies that you can see over and over again, but you were going to elaborate.
Where did I cut out?
You started to tell us a story after you mentioned your father randomly asking you this.
Did I tell you about being in Prestonsburg, Kentucky, doing summer theater?
Good God, no. Old theater stories. Go. I can't wait.
Well, I was stuck in a trailer all year in a dry county with no car. And my mom, I had two VHS tapes for the entire summer and no TV reception at all. So all summer I was stuck with two VHS tapes. So this is the desert island.
My God.
So the three movies, you are stuck on the desert island or the moon or wherever. You can only have three movies. You've got a video player that will play in perpetuity. You can only have three movies that you will watch for the rest of time. What are those moves going to be? No. And let me make this clear. No series. You have to choose individual films. You cannot say series. What are the three movies you would be willing to be stuck on a desert island with for the rest of time?
All right. All right. That's a good
one. My recorder run D.W. Griffith movies? I need to know this.
You only have a PSP.
I don't even know what that stands for.
All right, so tune in next week to find out our 3x3 for the three movies we would take to a desert island. Not that that's a cliched question or anything. You never hear that.
Bloody blah.
And also,
especially after so much setup, you never hear that. You never hear 5 minutes of setup and then go, desert island.
Well, your short story ruined the one I was going to choose, but thanks, Tom.
And wait a minute, what are you talking about?
You'll have to find out later.
Well, and also, apologies to everyone in Gainesburg, Kentucky, or wherever, who now think it's you just drew a parallel between that city and a desert island. So to all of our listeners in Kentucky, we apologize for anything Dingus may have said to slight your fine state.
I didn't know Kentucky was an island.
Apparently, Dingus compares it to a desert island. But I can imagine being stuck there.
Arkansas, I know, is the middle of nowhere.
Hey, how dare you?
Oh, ouch!
So tune in next week for that, our 3x3, and we will be seeing and talking about The Road. So see it before then, and then join us for a spoiler-filled discussion. Until then, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to everyone next week.
TTYRL.
GG.
I'm James.
One, two, three, everybody look at me. Oops, what's going on?
Young teacher, the subject of schoolgirl.
You hear Tom sort of chortling in the background. As he wants us to sing, don't stand so close to me.